Good morning. It's very good to see everyone here this morning. And as always, it's a pleasure and an honor to be able to stand before you and to present a message from the Word of God. I want to invite you to grab your Bible and turn all the way to the end of the Old Testament. Doesn't matter where just yet, just towards the end of the Old Testament. If I ask you to name a book of the Bible that is all about a man who looks at his circumstances and struggles to understand why bad things are happening all around him and questions God about those things, what book would you say that describes? Well, you might answer the book of Job, which is a perfectly fine answer. That's a mighty good answer. But there is at least one other book you could name that also fits that description perfectly. And it's a book that doesn't get nearly as much love as the book of Job, but boy, is it a great book. And I'm talking about the book of Habakkuk. So let's find that at the end of our Old Testaments between Nahum and Zephaniah. The book of Habakkuk. This is one of the books in our collection of what we call minor prophets. Minor, not because they are unimportant or less important, but because they are often smaller works in scope and scale in comparison to the works of prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Daniel and Ezekiel. And that's really one of the great things about Habakkuk, especially for the purposes of a study like this, where we have half an hour or so, is that it is bite-sized. It is only three chapters, whereas if we tried to fit Job into one lesson, that's 42 chapters, be a little bit more of a struggle. But three chapters to Habakkuk, and we get a very similar message. Habakkuk is the name of the man that we meet in this book. And we don't really know a lot about the personal life of Habakkuk, apart from the fact that he was a righteous man and he was very concerned about the affairs of his nation and about the things that were going on around him. Habakkuk is an unusual name, isn't it? One that maybe we struggle even to pronounce at times. I know I have. I suspect that that's not just an unusual name by today's standards, but probably even in Habakkuk's time. You don't just really read about a whole lot of Habakkuks in the Bible, or elsewhere for that matter. And as best as I could find, it is derived from the Hebrew verb for the word embrace, and probably means he who embraces or he who clings. I don't know if that name necessarily has any significance to the message of his book. Sometimes we try and tie significance into a person's name and what they write. It could be that he who embraces has something to say about the message of Habakkuk, but I don't know that for sure. Anytime we study a prophet, we talk about the prophet's work or ministry. And in most of the prophetic books, that work is sitting right there out in the open. Think about a prophet like Jeremiah or Isaiah, for example. Whenever you open their books, you immediately see the work that God sets out for that prophet to do. Go and speak to my people, or go and speak to these nations and say this to them, deliver this message to them. Sometimes they were called to do bizarre things or seemingly bizarre things in order to communicate the word of God and his message. But almost always when you open a prophet, you get an idea of what the work of that prophet is. But that's not really how this book of Habakkuk goes. You don't really get an idea of what his work is from just opening the book and starting to read. If you have Habakkuk open, let's read verse 1. The way that this book begins, the oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw, or maybe your version says the burden that Habakkuk the prophet saw. With those opening words, you might expect that what directly follows would be God, as he does with many of the prophets, taking the prophet and saying, listen, this is the message I'm going to give you. Go and take it to my people. But that's not what Habakkuk does. That's not how this book goes. Even though from the opening passage we see that he was given an oracle or given a burden, in other words, a burden of something that he had to take to other people, we don't really know what that burden or oracle is just from the beginning of the book. In fact, Habakkuk is one of those prophets that kind of challenges me to go back and think about what the work and what the definition of a prophet is. Because what this book is complaining. Habakkuk brings complaints to God. And lest you think I'm being too harsh on him by calling them complaints and not concerns or something, even Habakkuk will say, this is my complaint. It is identified in the book as complaining. He looks around him and he sees injustice and he sees violence and he complains to God and he brings questions and concerns to God. When I think of a prophet, I think of a spokesman for God, someone who warns the nations of impending judgment, someone who promotes God's law and his will. But we really don't get a good picture of how Habakkuk did that or what exactly he was assigned to do in that way. This is more just him questioning God and getting answers from God and making a way of understanding how that's going to come about and making peace with the answer that he gets. So it is very much like Job in that way. And let me say that I believe there are a couple of places in this book that suggest that Habakkuk was a prophet in the traditional sense, that he did bring a message to people. But Habakkuk's career, so to speak, as a prophet is not necessarily the main focus of this book, but rather the questions that he raises. It's a book about a man who looks around him and sees terrible things happening in his country, and he wonders what God is going to do about it and if there is a plan at all in place. So let's look at the first section of this book and see Habakkuk's exchange with God. And complaint number one, I guess I'll summarize it in this way. How long, Habakkuk asks, are you going to let violence and injustice dominate your people? He looks around at his country and at what is supposed to be God's people, the land of Judah and the city of Jerusalem, and all he sees is violence and injustice. And I want those two words to stick in your head. Violence and injustice. Those are the main things that Habakkuk is concerned about. So look in verse 2. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear, or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity and why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth, for the wicked surround the righteous. So justice goes forth perverted. Habakkuk complains to God, again, about two things mainly, and that is violence and injustice. Now, most Bible students, clear-thinking Bible students, will open up Habakkuk and with just a little bit of research and a little bit of looking at what comes in this book, especially here in chapter 1 and a little bit in chapter 2, will find that the setting of this book is right at the time when the nation of Assyria fell from power and Babylon was on the rise as the great world power that it would become. And a date that's often assumed for this book is 609 B.C. 609 B.C. And the reason that that date is important is because that is the year that Josiah, and Josiah is the last good king that Judah would ever have. If you're to walk back into the Bible classes, back where they have the smiley face kings and the frowny face kings, Josiah is going to be the last smiley face king that you see in Judah, and the rest are going to be frowny. He is the last good king that Judah is going to have. And in 609 BC, that is the year that Josiah died. For whatever reason, and I don't know that we're ever really given a good reason, the king of Egypt at this time was going up north to join forces with Assyria and go to war against Babylon. And Josiah decided it would be a good idea, and this is the thing that I don't know a reason why, he decided it would be a good idea to intercept the king of Egypt and to try and intervene there. And Josiah was killed in battle. And after King Josiah died in 609 BC, his sons took his place in Judah, and they were lousy. They were lousy by every standard. They were wicked. They were unjust. They were violent. And what we read in Habakkuk is going to strengthen our understanding of what that was like. What you read in Jeremiah is going to strengthen your understanding of what their reign was like. The sons of Josiah were not good leaders. And particularly, I want to focus on one of them. His name was Jehoiakim. He was one of the sons of Josiah that reigned after Josiah died. And you'll remember that Jehoiakim was the king that whenever Jeremiah had his scribe Baruch that would follow him around and record the things that Jeremiah said and did. And the officials in the kingdom at the time saw these things that Jeremiah was doing and saw the scroll that Baruch produced. And they took that scroll to the king and they said, the king needs to read this. That was Jehoiakim. And you remember what he did with that scroll. Whenever the official started to read it, just a couple of columns in, he grabbed it and cut it up with his knife and threw it into the fire. He did not want to hear the things of God. And that's really a good characterization of what Josiah's sons were like. They did not have any interest in doing right, and they were not good leaders. So this is what Habakkuk now sees in the land of Judah. Josiah, the last good king of Judah, has died, and his sons are in his place, and all he sees is violence and ungodliness and wickedness, violence and the other one, injustice. Violence and injustice. There are two major events in my lifetime when I can remember hearing out loud both Christians and non-Christians saying things like, where is God? And is there a God? And especially for Christians, what is the plan that God has with all of this? How is He working all things together for good? Two major events in my life when I can remember people really questioning what God had in store for everyone. And the first one was the 9/11 attacks on New York in 2001. Do you remember what that was like if you were alive at the time to hear people really wonder where things were going and if things were just going to get worse and worse? And the second event I can remember in my lifetime when I heard both Christians and non-Christians alike really wondering what plan was in store or if anything was going to get better was the recent election in this country. From both sides, whether you know left or right, whatever your political stance was, it was maybe a scary time, for some an exciting time, but a scary time. And many wondered, is there a plan in place? Is God doing? Is God going to take this somewhere? One of those events, the 2001 attacks, people wondered about God because of violence. And one of those events, the recent election, people wondered about God because of injustice and what the political landscape was like and what leadership was like. Those are the two major events in my lifetime that stick out to me. Maybe there are others, but those are just two in recent memory or in memory of my lifetime where people question God. And I think it's interesting that Habakkuk focuses on those two things, violence and injustice. And he wonders, God, where are you? And what are we doing here? And what is the plan? For any times that you might wonder that kind of question, where is God and what is he doing? You could say that Habakkuk asked that question 2,600 years ago so that you don't have to. And he got an answer. And he came to a conclusion that is just as good 2,600 years later as it was when he received it. The answer that God gave him, first of all, is, well, you know, Habakkuk asked, how long, God, will violence and injustice continue among your people? And God say, well, not much longer. Babylon is on the way. I'm bringing Babylon in to bring judgment on my people. So he says in verse 5, look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. He says in verse 11, then they sweep by like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own might is their God. So just think about that for a minute. Habakkuk is worried about the state of his country and all the ungodliness and violence and injustice. And he says, God, what are you doing about this? This is your people and you're watching them be violent to each other and unjust to each other. And what are you doing? And God says, don't worry about it. I've got it covered. I've got a plan in place. I'm going to bring Babylon to bring judgment on my people and to ultimately destroy them and haul them off to captivity. And many will murder each other, and they'll starve, and everything's going to be chaos. I've got a plan. What kind of questions would you have for God if that was His answer to you today? If you wondered where things were going, and He said, well, don't worry, I'm going to bring another nation to come and destroy the United States. Well, you might wonder, how would that solve anything? How is that going to take care of the problem at all? And that's exactly what Habakkuk wonders. He basically asks God, have you completely lost your mind? What is that going to accomplish? In verse 12, are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. Some versions say, you shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? You see what Habakkuk is saying? I understand, God, that our nation is not righteous right now. We're not doing what is right. But what are you thinking bringing in a more wicked nation to punish us? How is that going to accomplish anything? And he says in verse 16, therefore, talking about Babylon, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? He describes Babylon as this fisherman that's just casting a net and kind of killing fish for sport. And that's what Babylon did with the nations, a murderous and violent nation. And then Habakkuk says in chapter 2 and verse 1, I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. God, what's the plan when you say that you're going to bring in another nation to judge your people? How is that going to solve anything? Now, here's something that's interesting to me. Habakkuk knew the history of God's people, and he knew that God uses wicked nations to accomplish his purposes. He knew that God had used Assyria to accomplish his purposes, that Assyria was the arm of God's wrath. Over in Isaiah chapter 10, there's one passage about Assyria, about that other nation before Babylon, that God used to judge even Israel, the northern kingdom. In Isaiah 10 and verse 5, Isaiah the prophet had spoke, woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, the staff in their hands is my fury. Against a godless nation I send him, and against the people of my wrath I command him to take spoil and seize plunder and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. God says, I'm using Assyria as a tool, as an instrument to accomplish my judgment. Now, was Assyria going to escape God's wrath and God's judgment once God had used them? Not a chance. He was going to bring judgment on them as well. And that's why Isaiah pronounced woes upon Assyria. And the interesting thing to me is Habakkuk knew these passages. He knew that God had used nations like Assyria in the past. And yet he looks at God's plan now to use Babylon to come in and judge Judah. And he says, what are you thinking, God? So let me ask you this. Why would Habakkuk be puzzled by God using a nation like Babylon if he knows that God works in that way? Well, perhaps because this time it's close to home. This time it's not just Habakkuk reading a story in Isaiah about something that happened maybe a century ago to, yes, his people, but people who lived a long time ago. This time he is talking to God, and God says, I'm going to do this to your people, to my people, to those you live among. Perhaps the story of Habakkuk is a good reminder that sometimes when we're very close to a situation, we have cloudy judgment. We can't see the plan of God as clearly because we're just too close and too emotionally involved. That's the case for Habakkuk. He looks at this and says, what is your plan, God? When really I think he knew exactly what God was doing and knows how God works. And so God answers him. His second complaint was, how is this really going to solve anything? What are you trying to do here, God, by bringing in this wicked nation? And God answers, don't worry, I'm going to judge Babylon too. In verse 2 of chapter 2, it says, the Lord answer me, write the vision, make it plain on table so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But the righteous shall live by his faith. Does that passage, the righteous shall live by faith or by his faith, sound familiar? Paul quotes that several times in the New Testament in his epistles, in Galatians, in Romans. Paul liked what Habakkuk said there. The righteous shall live by his faith. What did that mean for Habakkuk? Perhaps it meant looking at his circumstances, looking at the things that he even knew God was about to do. Babylon is going to come in to Judah. And yet still being able to look at that in faith and say, I trust God and I believe God, even though he's bringing in a destructive nation among my people. In chapter 2, God pronounces woes on the Chaldeans, which is another name for the Babylonians. This is actually the second iteration of the Babylonian Empire, and they referred to themselves as the Chaldeans. In chapter 2, in verses 6 through 8, we find God pronouncing woes on Babylon for their plundering. He says in verse 6, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own. For how long? And loads himself with pledges. Will not your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who make you tremble? In other words, there's only so long that you can be a plundering, terrible nation and treat everybody bad before they come back to get you. You will reap what you sow, God says. The second woe in verses 9 through 11 is about evil gain. He says in verse 9, woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork respond. God says, it's like if you treat everyone terribly, and you plunder and you get gain by evil means, and then you go and try and hide in your house from everyone, even the stone and the wood is going to cry out and say, he's over here, come and get him. That's how terrible Babylon was, and that's what's going to be repaid them. In verses 12 through 14 and in verses 15 through 17, these two woes have to do with the violence that Babylon practiced. In verse 15, woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness, the violence done to their neighbor. And then in verse 17, the violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. How interesting that God says, your violence done to Lebanon. Lebanon was known for the cedar trees. And Babylon wasn't just terrible to the nations that they came through and destroyed. They were terrible to the land also. They were terrible to God's creation. And when they came through Lebanon, they destroyed the cedar trees. They destroyed meaninglessly the things that God had created. And in Jeremiah chapter 22, that's one passage where Jeremiah condemned these kings, the sons of Josiah, for building up their houses with these cedars that they had just kind of ripped down needlessly. In verses 18 through 20, it's for their idolatry that God pronounces this woe. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. This chapter is God telling Habakkuk, don't worry, I'm going to destroy Babylon too. Now I'll ask you honestly, if God gave a pronouncement of judgment like he did for Habakkuk on our country, and said there's going to be another country come in and destroy the United States, destroy America, But he said, don't worry, I'm going to destroy that country too. Would that make you feel any better? Well, what do you think Habakkuk felt? In chapter 3, the book of Habakkuk ends with a prayer. And it also seems like it could be a song, or was a song. In the last verse of chapter 3, it says, to the choir master with stringed instruments. I don't know exactly which part that refers to, but seems to refer to the entire chapter. This prayer of Habakkuk is all about what God had done for his people in the past. In chapter 3 and verse 2, he talks about how God had rescued his people and refers back to these historical events we can look in the Old Testament and find. In verse 2, he says, O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work. O Lord, I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens and the earth was full of His praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from His hand and there He veiled His power. Before Him went pestilence and plague followed at His heels. Verse 5 there speaks of the pestilence and plague that God brought upon Egypt in order to rescue His people from the bonds of slavery in that land. Verse 7 speaks of the inhabitants of the promised land. As God brings His people in, they would flee from before them because they had heard of the wondrous things that God had done. In the second part of that chapter 3, Habakkuk talks about how God fought for His people. In verse 9, he says, you strip the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. Verse 11 there talks about the time when Joshua spoke to God for the sun to stand still. And indeed, God caused it to happen and gave Israel a great victory over the Amorites in Joshua chapter 10. Verse 14 seems to speak of the battle in Judges 7 where God gave Israel the victory over Midian by confusing the Midianite armies so that they attacked each other. And what Habakkuk is doing by calling to memory these events when God brought His people out of Egypt, when He protected them, when He fought for them and gave them victory, Habakkuk is saying, you've done it before, and I want you, God, to please fight for us again. Fight for your people again. Let's step back for a minute and appreciate what doesn't happen at this point. God does not relent from His plan to bring Babylon into Judah in judgment against His people. Habakkuk cries out to God to do that, and God does not say, I'm going to relent from my plan and turn the armies away. Habakkuk cried in chapter 1 about violence all around him, but the violence was about to get immeasurably worse. In chapter 1, he also cried about injustice all around him, but there is no measure to the injustice that is about to come when Babylon enters the land. We know what's going to happen in Judah. Babylon's going to besiege the city. Thousands will be murdered. Many will be left to starve and devour their own. While the best and the brightest, like Daniel and his friends, are not going to remain in the land, they're going to be taken off to Babylon to join their ranks and to be trained to be Babylonian armies. There is almost no good news coming for Judah and for Habakkuk. And I think you can see that pretty clearly in Habakkuk's sentiments in verse 16, that he knows what's coming. I hear, he says in verse 16, and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Habakkuk knows that there's no good coming to Judah. The things that he's prayed for as far as physical deliverance from the army or for God to turn away these things, is not going to happen. God's going to bring Babylon into Judah. Can I ask you a question as we bring Habakkuk's book to a close? We started the lesson with some questions that we might have every day. You know, how is God going to make this happen in my life? How is God going to take care of me? Does God have a plan? And maybe just everyday questions that you have. Will we have enough money for the month? Will my family be okay? Is my job situation going to change? Will my kids be okay? Will my marriage work out? We have those kind of questions, just as Habakkuk did on a grander scale as far as his nation. And here's my question: whatever concern plagues you right now, if it be financial, if it be marital, if it be work issues, health issues, relationship issues, if you knew for a fact that things would not get better, if God were able to speak to you and say, in this life, it's not going to get any better for you, it's only going to get worse, the way it was for Habakkuk, could you still trust God? And could you still praise and worship Him, knowing that this life is not going to get any better? Habakkuk watched his nation crumble while he wondered what God was doing. And the hope he is given is ultimately that one day God is going to administer justice. Maybe not in this life, but one day God is going to take care of everything. And if the only promise you ever get from God is that He will make everything right in eternity, will that be enough for you to say, I'm still going to be faithful to Him? I want to end with Habakkuk's words in verses 17 through 19, some of the most beautiful that we find in the Old Testament. And the invitation this morning is to lay your cares at the feet of the cross, at the feet of Jesus, because the righteous live by faith, as Habakkuk has said and as Paul quoted. And I hope after the lesson you will take the opportunity, if you need it, to lay your burdens at the feet of Jesus and to lay your cares on us as well, to help us bear your burdens. But let's end with Habakkuk's final words of faith, even with the bad news that he gets from God. Verse 17 of chapter 3, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. And we say with Habakkuk that if there were no food, if there were no drink, if there were no prosperity, then still I would serve and trust God. If that's the case for you this morning, if you need to come forward, come while together we stand and sing.